Robin Daly with another Yes to Life show. This week, the new book, The Cancer Revolution, hit the bookstores, and you can now get yourself a copy from thecancerrevolution.co.uk. This is a moment that's been many years coming, but I think the resulting book has been worth the wait. My hope is that it's going to be a brilliant resource for people with cancer and will change lives for the better. Over the last few shows, I've been introducing you to several of the 38 expert contributors to the book, from the UK and from around the globe. I'm not quite done with this yet, and so this week I'm focusing in on two subjects: exercise and working with your oncology team. Exercise has been steadily gaining in importance as an essential strand of any integrative medicine program for cancer, as the evidence for its astonishing effects just keep on building. My first guest today is a specialist in exercise for those with cancer, ex-oncology nurse Lizzie Davis. I visited her in her studio in Crouch End, North London, to find out more. Good morning, Lizzie. Thanks so much for coming on the show to talk about your contribution to the cancer revolution.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so exercise is being hailed as the new wonder drug for cancer, at least in some circles. And there have been some pretty astonishing comparisons in recent years between exercise and conventional approaches. I saw a study comparing chemotherapy and exercise, which was pretty impressive. Can you start off by highlighting just a few of the sort of biggest wins that research has demonstrated recently?
Well, I went on a very interesting, I attended a very interesting conference last year at the Royal Marsden, and it was hailed as the exercise being the fourth treatment modality, which I saw as a massive win. I thought it was bold and brilliant, and to be honest, just completely reinforces what I believe to be the fourth treatment modality, obviously alongside nutrition and diet and rest and sleep. But I think to actually run an entire conference and study day for healthcare professionals and those involved in movement and physical exercise just reinforces the fact that there is enough research now out there to present it as the fourth treatment modality. Lots of studies out there, particularly with regards to those on treatment, in terms of reducing symptoms, side effects from treatment, the benefits of exercising. We all know that when we don't move, we don't feel very well. Just in, you know, just general health and well-being, in terms of trying to keep the body strong. And at the end of the day, we need resilience in the body for just general daily life. So when you're going through treatment, we need that resilience even more. We need the strength, we need the stamina, we need all the other cells in the body to function and to work well. So lots of studies, as I say, with regards to the benefits during treatment. Obviously we know post-treatment, the importance of keeping fit, keeping strong to reduce your risk of recurrence. So there's been quite a lot of studies working on that, particularly with regards to breast cancer. There's been a lot
of
studies.
That's so important, isn't it? Because a preliminary treatment can be successful, but then if you have a recurrence, the chances are it won't be.
Yeah.
So preventing recurrence is enormously important.
Enormously important. There's also been some very interesting studies done on trying to work with people right from the day of diagnosis. So so literally getting in there, starting to exercise right from the beginning. And if possible, there's now some new studies that have come out about prehabilitation. So not just thinking about rehabilitation,
new word,
I'm afraid, a bit of prehab and the benefits of actually being able to work with someone in terms of improving their strength, heart and lung strength or their muscular strength before they go and have surgery. And in terms of the recovery process then, being quicker, being a little shorter, because people have even just 2 or 3 weeks, even just a small amount before they go into surgery, has shown that their recovery times, their recovery responses, particularly after surgery, are improved. There's also a lot of studies out there in terms of people still living with cancer and the benefits of movement, regular movement, regular exercise. And I'm not talking about vigorous, unpleasant exercise. I'm talking about, I always like to try and talk about movement or physical activity, as opposed sometimes to exercise, so that it's a, you know, so it can be applicable to everybody, because not everybody wants to belong to a gym or run 10 kilometres. So just thinking about general movement, and definitely those living with perhaps advanced disease, the importance of regular gentle movement, deep breathing techniques. And again, there's been some research there. There's, I mentioned at the beginning, lots of research out there with regards to the breast cancer population, particularly with regards to lymphedema. Again, another big consequence, big side effect from treatment, and the benefits of movement and exercise there. Whereas historically, people were always encouraged to not move.
Absolutely.
Not move.
There's also some quite a bit of research in there around prostate cancer and just walking, basically.
Absolutely.
Is that right? Yeah?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just walking. I mean, literally, you know, the figures, the numbers that come back from the research, you're looking at kind of 30, 40, 50%. Big figures.
Major
figures.
If that was a drug, you'd be hearing
about
it all
absolutely.
Over the
front pages. If that was a drug, it would be on every single shelf and everybody would be buying it.
Yeah.
But yeah, big figures in terms of definitely trying to reduce recurrence and in terms of people tolerating treatments better. Because at the end of the day, if you can reduce the side effects, reduce the fatigue, you'll get through the treatment quicker.
Yeah,
things won't have to be delayed.
Mm.
Things won't have to be postponed.
Mm.
So it's a no-brainer.
It is a no-brainer
because
it's not a direct comparison. When you say if it was a drug, the trouble is if it was a drug, there would be negatives that came with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no drug that doesn't have negatives with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but there aren't any with exercise, really.
There aren't any. But I always try and explain to people when they're doing their exercise or their physical activity that they dose it a bit like you prescribe your medicine, prescribe your exercise. And I truly believe that, you know, all of us are different. There is no size fits all, or one size fits all, rather. It's a very individualized approach. And everybody who's going through treatment or living with cancer has different challenges every day, different accomplishments every day. And it's really important. Safety for me is the most important thing. You take the precautions necessary and you dose your exercise according to how you feel each day, because you can, the way you feel can vary so hugely during treatment. One day you feel okay, the next day not so great.
Yeah.
So safety, very, very important. Making sure that you prescribe, you know, realistic and achievable goals each day.
Right.
And whether that is just going for a nice walk, or sometimes it might just be a 10-minute walk that day if fatigue is very overwhelming. But you know, it's just about, I always say it's about consistency as well.
Right.
Try and be
keep
consistent, because we all know that once we take those trainers off and chuck them in the cupboard, it's very difficult to pull them back out again. But, you know, very much prescribing the exercise individually. Super, super important.
Okay, well, look, you've already referred to the fact that it's a kind of a complete turnaround in the view of exercise by the medical profession. Every single illness, it was like, lie down, go to bed, keep warm, all
rest
that stuff.
Is best.
Yeah, all that stuff was just like, that was the very basics, basically, of nursing, like. And so, you know, that's such a huge turnaround. So maybe you could just talk a bit about the change in thinking that's prompted that turnaround.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. Well, my background is nursing.
Okay.
I was an oncology nurse
for
many years, and then I was a CNS as well. And I have to confess, I spent a large portion of my career telling people to rest. And there was the myth of rest is best. And I think that was really what everybody thought was the right thing throughout the entire medical profession, the nursing profession.
Every,
I think physios
every
mum in the land thought that, absolutely. And I think physios were probably the only people that were slightly in disagreement with the rest of us. But it's thankfully changed, and we all know that when you get unwell, if you lay in bed for a few days, you feel awful.
It's true.
You feel lousy. You know, you have a really nasty cold or you get flu and you're laid up for a week.
Mm.
You get out of bed finally, or you get off the sofa and you feel terrible. And it's extraordinary just how much stamina you can lose just with a general illness. So, you know, thanks to the bulk of research that's come out, a lot of it obviously has come from America initially, but we're now starting to top that up with studies in Europe and obviously the UK. But thankfully, I think we've all kind of realised that actually sedentary behaviour doesn't do us any good.
No, we're animals of movement.
We are animals. We're creatures of movement. Yeah, we're meant to move. And, you know, I always like to get this across. We do now live in a very sedentary world.
Yeah.
More than ever. And I have clients and patients that I see, and they aren't sitting at a desk at work all day, but they are sitting at home on their laptops and their iPads for very prolonged periods of time.
Mm.
And it's amazing. I mean, we're all capable of this. We put the computer on, we sit down, we have a cup of tea, and 3 hours later we get up.
Mm.
It's a long time. It's a long time.
Add that to the TV.
Add that to your sleeping at night. And the body isn't moving very well. And we need, you know, the heart and lungs to be strong, the bones, the joints, the muscles.
Mm.
We need the physical frame that carries us around each day to build resilience, to build strength, to build stamina, to boost your immune system. Let's get that one right out there.
Yeah. Yeah,
the immune system is
now,
not boosted
yeah.
when we're resting all day. Mm. And we need your immune system. You need the lymphatic system as well as the blood system, the two very, very integral components, fluid components of the body. We need both of those to be working in tip-top condition. And rest and inactivity is not good for that. And when we sit and we're sedentary, we don't breathe properly. So there's that, you know, inadequate exchange of gases.
Mm.
You know, we need, you know, you need your blood composition to be healthy, and we need the lymphatic system to be pumping and moving. And that doesn't move unless we move.
No, right.
It's not pumped by the heart, it's pumped by...
Stagnant.
Yeah, stagnant. Yeah. It's a stagnant pond,
yeah.
and we need it to
yeah.
be a flowing, sparkling
right.
stream of fluid.
Yeah. Well, it's heartening that, you know, I'm beginning to hear of doctors actually now prescribing exercise as a medicine. So,
slowly.
I mean, that's just like awesome, isn't it? It's so different to drugs, isn't it?
Yeah.
And but it is beginning to happen. Obviously, as you know, it happens a lot more in America because you can get it paid for over there. You know,
you can get it paid
as
for
as part of your Medicare or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, interesting.
But I think in terms of obviously over here, it is harder. There's a lot of more financial strain, and sadly, exercise movement is not part of the prescription. But I'd like to think that more and more consultants and specialist nurses are becoming more aware. And I think popping, you know, these conference days like the one I went to last year, it's slowly trickling out there that we need to encourage people to move. It's all very well giving people these big drugs, these big treatments without supporting the rest of the body. And to build that resilience, which is so, so important. And I do see it happen all the time where people are receiving, you know, very complex treatment regimes that's taking a huge physical and emotional toll on the body.
Mm-hmm.
And there needs to be more encouragement in how we can boost and support the body during this, through nutrition, through exercise, and we're kind of off the back foot of America, really, but it's slowly coming through, slowly.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, of course, this is the big message of the cancer revolution, is that there's an awful lot of things you can do that are 100% positive in general, supportive, will improve the condition of your body, and therefore whatever other treatment you're doing, you're going to do better. That's all there is to it, because you're in better shape, and exercise is clearly a huge...
And also a book like yours... It can offer people such empowerment.
Right.
Because for a lot of people, they really don't know. No one's told them to move. No one's told them to eat better foods. no one's given them that advice. Or they may well have said, well, actually, do some exercise. but what? Where do I start? Yeah. How do I begin?
Absolutely,
you know, yeah. I've got peripheral neuropathy. I've a risk of lymphedema. I've got osteopenia. I could list.
Exercise, yes.
Yeah. What do I do? How
I've
do
just
I get
had surgery,
started?
You know,
yeah,
but,
I've just
yeah,
had surgery. My yeah. range of motion is compromised. Mm. I don't know what I should and shouldn't do. Mm. It's a bit stiff. It's a bit sore. Mm. How do I work with that? And thankfully, you know, books like yours will hopefully help patients unravel some of those unanswered questions or worries,
right.
and at least have some, it's a tool. I always say to people, it's a bit like having a toolbox, and as many tools as you can put in there that you can utilize, that you can grab, that you can take. And there are more and more little groups popping up around the country, slowly, offering exercise and movement to, you know, groups of patients, and also offering, you know, perhaps one-to-one sessions. But again, you know, they're not free. So it's...
I know. Well, that's the bit that needs to change.
It does need
to be part of our health service, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It needs to be a whole integrated approach.
Of course. I mean, this is the stuff the government's been talking about for ages, which is self-empowerment. And people being actively promoting their own health, so they don't cost the health service a fortune. It's true; it'll save money in the end. If it's, but you've got to invest to make it happen.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm. So you know, as with most things to do with cancer, we've already sort of alluded to the fact that exercise, simple as it may sound, in the case of cancer patient, is quite a complex area. There's lots of pitfalls and the caveats in there, and so you've trained especially to help people with cancer. So maybe you would talk a little bit about your training, why you've become a specialist cancer trainer. So,
well, as I said, my background was in nursing. I spent many years as an oncology nurse, then I became a CNS, and I worked in palliative care for several years. And I then experienced my mother being diagnosed with very advanced lung cancer, and it was really then, and I think that it made me reflect back on all the work that I've been doing over the years, and seeing now, obviously very personally, the way my mother was deteriorating, it made me realise then and there that this rest is best was just not the way forward. This kind of constant deteriorating accumulation of physical functioning, and I thought, well, no, there needs to be more around this whole area of keeping the body strong and fit. So I decided to jump ship a little bit. So I still work with the same population because I'm very passionate about what I do, and the people that I work, the extraordinary people that I work with, and I went off and trained with an organisation here. Called Can Rehab, and there's various, I think, around the country now offering the same thing, and it's a cancer exercise rehabilitation qualification, but I also have very significant training, exercise training background as well, so I kind of was just topping up really, and
specialist
that
knowledge.
Specialist that combined with all my knowledge of obviously understanding the cancer pathway and the treatment modalities, although that is changing every 5 minutes at the moment with regards to new treatments and targeted treatments. But that combined with obviously my expertise, and I've also gone and done some extra additional training on movement and the lymphatic system for those at risk of lymphedema and those with lymphedema to just enhance my professional skill mix. And I continue to do many things, actually. I'm very focused on breath work because I really believe that there is no good movement without good breath. And it's the one thing that people don't do properly. It's the one thing we do all day. Our body does it for us at night, during the day, and we never breathe properly. So I do a lot of work with breath. And again, I think the power of breath is not to be understated either.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in the book we have these therapeutic target icons throughout the book in the margins, which are sort of things that you might aim to try and achieve therapeutically, and one of them is to increase your oxygen levels, because mm-hmm. there's lots of reasons to do that,
yeah.
Apart from just feeling better generally and having
yeah.
more energy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's actually a really good thing to do for your health generally, particularly
yeah.
when you have cancer. So, of course, there's lots of little oxygen
yeah.
Icons next to your writing and all the other
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
to do with
just
exercise.
Breathe.
Breathing, you know.
Breathe.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
is the, kind of the obvious one that we do all the time.
It is, and if this makes people feel any better, when I go to classes, when I do certain things, I need people to remind me to breathe, because
okay.
we just kind of forget sometimes.
Right.
You know, we get very focused on doing something particular and we forget. And let's not underestimate the importance of breath work physiologically, but also just emotionally, how it can really help.
I was going to say that well, it works both ways, isn't it? Because the emotions can actually stunt the breath when
yeah.
you're in fear all the time or whatever,
yeah, yeah.
Which people are around cancer. There's a lot of fear and all sorts of other emotions. But as you say, it works the other way. If you actually breathe well, it helps with all those things, doesn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, absolutely. We
two
know
way.
In times of trauma and crisis, we stop the breath always, because it's that kind of shock situation, and the chest wall contracts,
yeah.
and the rib cage pulls in. And I think it's that protection perhaps of the heart, the lungs, the essential things that keep us alive. But we do, we stop the most critical thing that we need to do in life.
Yeah.
And we know that it helps, obviously, with the physics, with the physical, you know, mechanics of the body, but also with regards to pain.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm a big fan of breathing.
Right. Okay. Well, look, exercise is featured prominently in the Cancer Revolution for a very good reason. Do you want to just give us a quick summary of why you think that nobody who's got cancer should miss this trick?
No, nobody should miss the trick of exercise, regardless of your age, the physical limitations that you've got. And I think that's really important as well, that there's lots of ways you can work around things with regards to movement. You can do it sitting in a chair, laying in a bed, standing. You can do it in your front room. You don't have to go to a fancy gym. You don't need any fancy equipment. You can use cans of beans, bottles of water. You find friends to support you, buddies to help you. And the most important thing is finding something fun. Find something
right.
you enjoy. That is so crucial.
Mm.
There is no point trying to put together a little kind of weekly, week by week exercise plan if you really can't stand what you're doing, because you will just stop doing it. So, you know, even if it's just dancing around your living room, combine that with some stretches up the wall, making sure don't move your top plates down, keep your top plates up on the top shelf and move your body to reach them. You know, just being creative. We don't need any fancy gimmicks. I mean, there's lots of stuff available, thankfully, now. Lots of videos, DVDs, podcasts, YouTube. There's lots of ways and means of being able to keep active. And thinking about the whole body. Try and think about the whole body.
Mm.
So try and think about a bit of strength, deep breathing, a little bit of aerobic stamina, whether that's walking, cycling, even just laying in bed and pedaling your legs in the air.
Right.
Yeah, like you're pedaling a bike, an imaginary upside down bike. Anything, you know, a bit, as I said, some flexibility, very important. Balance, very, very important. We all know that gets worse as we get older. But again, making sure that you've got safety precautions in place. Don't try any balance, obviously, if you've got any neuropathy or anything like that. Mm. And I think just start as soon as possible and continue. And one thing I always say to people is, it's really hard getting started. It's really, really hard getting started, particularly if fatigue is very overwhelming, or if you've never been an exerciser.
Right.
All right. And that's a lot of people out there. They've never exercised, and they're very fearful and very anxious. And obviously, sometimes the physical body has changed so much as well, and it's kind of gaining that trust within that body again, and it's connecting with the body. This frame carries us around all the time, and as we tend to kind of lose sight of that frame. So, you know, and I always say to people, you can leave your trainers by the door and then one day put them on. And whenever we all try to get going, it's really hard, and we think of 101 reasons as to why we shouldn't do any exercise. But when you come back from having done your exercise, even if you're just walking around the house for 10 minutes, guarantee at the end, you're not going to say, I wish I'd never done that.
No.
Ugh. Guaranteed at the end, you think, okay, feel a bit better. Glad I did that. Yeah, that feels good. That was good.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll do it again.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's using lots of different creative ways to keep you going. And I always think support of friends is great. Someone who's going to bang on your door and go, right, come on.
Brilliant.
We're going out.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going
right.
for a walk.
Yeah.
We're going for a walk.
Yeah.
Or meet your friends, have a coffee. But meet your friends and have a coffee and go for a walk at the same time.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, that's really great. Thanks so much. Very inspiring, Lizzie. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who will pick up on that inspiration. So thanks.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Great to have the case for exercise made so eloquently by Lizzie. I thoroughly enjoyed my visit. Next, I'm speaking to an oncologist, Dr. Henry Mannings, over Skype. Henry is a wonderful, big-hearted doctor who has set up his own charity, Star Throwers, to fill the gaps in care that he experienced in the NHS. He contributed a very important and useful practical chapter to the Cancer Revolution entitled Be Informed, which is packed with real-world tips on navigating the often tricky waters of the NHS and on getting the most from your oncology team. Hi, Henry. Thanks so much for coming on today's show.
My pleasure. Nice to hear from you again, Robin. It's been a long time.
Great. So you're an oncologist with long experience of working in the NHS and of supporting people with cancer. To start off today, I'd like you to indulge in a little utopian reverie and tell us what your ideal would be for the way that new patients are handled in oncology units in the NHS, what you'd like to see happening.
Well, I think ideally, Robin, I think one of the biggest problems with patients within the NHS is that they haven't got enough time to discuss exactly what is going on. The amount of patients who come to see us here at Star Throwers who literally have no understanding whatsoever of their treatment protocol never ceases to amaze me. And unfortunately, it's just a fact of life that the oncologists in hospital are limited in time to how much they can spend with each patient. But despite that, I feel some of them haven't got any excuse for, you know, how extremely limited, you know, the patients who come back here, how limited their knowledge is. And I feel, you know, one of the most important things I use here is a simple whiteboard, and I can draw simple pictures on it to explain to the patient exactly what is going on, why they need this treatment, etc. And I think, you know, rather than the oncologists spending their lives just looking at the sort of computer screen and, you know, even looking at the CT scan results or the CT scan of the patient, but not showing the patient on the CT scan what the problem is, you know, they don't interact with the patient. It's all, I'm the oncologist, you're the patient, and I will tell you what to do. And I think this is what could, it has to change. You know, it's supposed to be that interaction. You know, we work together on your disease. It's not me telling you what to do.
Right. Okay. That's a good different picture. You're right. So it's information, basically, and communication are the two things you've highlighted there. Okay. So as a cancer patient, your oncologist is a key player in your integrative team. That's the team of people who are supporting you and taking on your situation. But a slight difficulty is that very few oncologists in the UK look at themselves in that way. They do have a tendency to see themselves as the only person affecting the progress of your disease. So in large part, this is why your chapter in the Cancer Revolution, Be Informed, is so important. I wondered if you'd like to say a little about how you feel someone should position themselves in relation to their treatment and give some tips as to how to get the most out of your oncologist and their team.
Well, as I say, Robin, the only way to get the most out of the oncologist, as you say, is to be informed in the first place. You know, okay. This goes back to places like Star Throwers here, where people can come and discuss their tumours, whatever, you know, the what they've had so far, what treatments have been offered to them in the future. And I think the most important thing is, you know, you have to be in control of the decision making. Right? It's not the oncologist to make the decision for you. And sometimes that's very difficult when you don't understand anything about medicine, especially cancer medicine. But it, you know, if you've got any sense at all, you will make the effort to find out, you know, either by reading up about it or contacting one of the charities who hopefully will sort of point you in the right direction for further information. As I said before, you know, this is joint decision making between the consultant and you, and but you can only make joint decision making if you can argue your point. And by arguing a point, you have to understand what's going on. And if they offer you one treatment and you actually know there's another treatment available, then you have to be able to ask, why are you not having this treatment? And basically, you have to make sure that treatment is also available either in the hospital you're at or elsewhere. And if that treatment is found to be better than the one you're being offered, then you're entitled to it.
Right. In order to be able to argue your case in this way, as you say, you've got to actually be pretty well informed. You've got to start to speak the language of oncology to some extent, and you've got to understand the mechanisms and effectiveness of some of these treatments in relation to your particular situation. So it's quite a tall order, isn't it?
It is. I totally agree, Robin. And it is very difficult, you know, especially, as I say, if you have no medical background at all, to do that. But I mean, I think that is why we've been so busy, you know, up here at Starthrowers, because, you know, people are coming to us because they're, you know, they don't understand what's going on and they've been offered things which they're not sure about. And because they're beginning to question, you know, I think people come to us are the people who question their treatment. And, you know, to be fair, probably 95% of the time, the treatment being offered is, you know, is the best optimal treatment. But there is 5% of patients I see, and I think, well, actually, no, in your particular case, I don't think this is the best treatment. But I have to explain to the patient in the best way possible, in simplistic terms to begin with, if they're not medical, you know, exactly what is going on. And once we explain what's going on, then to see why an alternative treatment may be better. And I give them the knowledge to go back to the oncologist and sort of say, well, what about this? And they... because they've now got the knowledge, they can then argue their case. And I think, you know, this is one of the hardest problems we have in this country, particularly, is that we have this, the oncologists are sort of, if you like, they're put on a pedestal. These are the experts, they're specialists, and we can't question them. Yeah, and this is where it's totally wrong. You know, we have to remember that cancer medicine is totally in its infancy. It's only been around, you know, well, it's been probably 100 years or so. And right at the beginning, we had surgery, then we had radiotherapy, then we, for a very short time, we had sort of immunotherapy in the form of Cody's toxins. And then the 1950s, we had chemotherapy came out. And, you know, since then, we've been stuck in this world of chemotherapy for 60 years. And, unfortunately, with a few exceptions, you know, such as testicular cancer and a few rare tumours of the womb in women, you know, and obviously the what I call the hematological cancers, such as leukemia and lymphoma, chemotherapy otherwise, you know, doesn't cure people unless you've got what we call minimal disease, i.e. you've had an operation to remove a big tumour and there are a few tumour cells left behind, then chemotherapy can, if you like, sort of wipe them up, if you like, what's left behind. But unfortunately for most other tumours, chemotherapy, it can certainly result in a large decrease in the size of the tumour, so it can't be seen, but it's quite rare to see a pathological complete response, i.e. when they do the surgery, all the tumour is completely gone. But, you know, as they do in breast cancer. It is seen, but it's rare. And just say, that's why whole things at the moment are changing, I'm glad to say, for the good. And I think we're going to see new things, well, that we've already seen new things coming in now for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years now. And this is going to change the face of cancer medicine, you know, in the next 20 years.
Meanwhile, there is still obviously a bit of a tendency to stick with the known, and there's a tendency to be offered what's been offered as the standard treatment for a long time, which everyone knows has a limited success. And as you say, it's good if patients are aware of the limitations of something like chemotherapy in their case. I mean, yes, you're right. It, obviously, it can be a miracle with some rare cancers, but in general, that's not true. But I think not so many people are aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think the thing that has to change is that patients have to become more aware when you're diagnosed or one of your family has been diagnosed with a tumour. You first of all, you need to speak to either your oncologist, your own doctor, or somebody else who understands a bit about cancer and understands, say, where the staging of the tumour is. Is the tumour localised? Has it spread elsewhere? And the reality is, if the tumour has spread elsewhere, that the chances of cure are reduced a lot. And these are the type of people who are going to be offered chemotherapy. Now, as I said before, chemotherapy, they can reduce tumour size a lot and occasionally cure. But the way the world is changing at the moment with the immunotherapy trials coming in, by which basically these drugs which are coming in are they're blocking, if you like, the messages coming from the tumour cells telling the immune system that there is nothing wrong. And this is the biggest problem we have. You know, our immune system is very good at fighting infections, but not cancers, because we realise over hundreds of thousands of years that infections can kill you. Whereas cancers have sort of developed this amazing ability to sort of turn off the immune system and sort of say, there's nothing wrong here, you don't need to worry. Now, from the patient's point of view, they need to be aware that these immunotherapy trials are coming on board. And at the moment, because most of them are just in trial, to get on them, you have to, on the vast majority of cases, you have to have completed at least one course of chemotherapy, because that's a sort of, if you like, the standard care of treatment. But once you've had that one course of chemotherapy, all patients these days should be looking around to sort of say, are there any immunotherapy trials around which I might be eligible for? Mm. And, you know, if we look at lung cancer, for example, or melanoma, which are the two big areas where the immunotherapy trials have been done, you know, the response rate is much higher than with chemotherapy. You know, we're not saying, you know, some people have been cured. We're not saying the vast majority are, because they're not. But they are living much longer, good quality of life. And so, I mean, immunotherapy, if you like, it's a new chemotherapy. And but hopefully it will, well, it's already shown that it will be more effective in the future. And it is your job to ask, not only ask your oncologist about immunotherapy trials once you've had one course of chemotherapy, but if he sort of says, oh, there's none available, then you need to research it further, either by coming to, you know, somebody like us at Staff Rose, or do your own research. And, you know, the other problem is that oncologists are busy people. They're not going to spend time looking around for you for trials elsewhere in the country. They'll tend to look at trials in their own hospital or maybe one referring hospital that they normally refer to. Outside that, they're not interested. And you have to do your own homework, find out where the trials are going on. And once you've found where a trial is going on, which you think you might be eligible for, then you should be able to print off that trial and take it to your consultant. So to say, look, I'm interested in this trial here. Would you refer me for this, please? And the other problem, of course, is because if you're non-medical, a lot of these trials, there's a lot of what are called inclusion criteria, exclusion criteria. And this is one of the biggest things, you know, to work out, am I actually eligible for this trial based on what I've got? And the only way you can do that, you know, is to talk to somebody with some cancer medicine knowledge. All right. And you say, we're available here. We're always, you know, willing to give people advice in that area if they want it.
Great. Well, look, your section in the book, it covers how to go about researching your own clinical trials on your own very effectively, which is fantastic. It's a great resource for people. I mean, in the scale of things, for somebody who's got a late stage cancer, how important do you think clinical trials are as a resource for their ongoing health?
I think when we talk about late stage cancer, you have to divide this into two areas, if you like. You can have late stage cancer where you go to the oncologist and he sort of says, sorry, you've had the two or three available chemotherapy regimes. Unfortunately, although you responded a little bit to begin with, the tumour has recurred and we have got no other options. Now, if that person is feeding fit and healthy, then there's absolutely no way that he should, you know, not think about looking at immunotherapy trials. But if it's totally different, the opposite way, I think if you've got to this stage, you've really given it everything you've done, you've had the chemotherapy, and you're starting to lose weight, you feel lethargic, and you don't feel good, then forget about trials. You've got to look after yourself first of all, you know. And this is where what we call the holistic integrative care comes in, and it's much more important to try other things which are available. And I'll go down that route.
So, just I'd like to hop back again now to the question of language, because there's a lot of words that an oncologist will use very normally in their everyday speech about what they're doing, which can be enormously misunderstood by patients. And I think you refer to this in your chapter. And, they might describe something as a complete response. And that if you just heard that and you didn't know anything about oncology, you would probably interpret it in a very different way to actually what's meant by an oncologist. Maybe you'd like to say a little bit about the importance of this language and of getting to grips with, exactly how they use these terms.
Yeah, absolutely, Robert. I think, I'm an experienced doctor. I've spent most of my life doing general medicine and acute emergency medicine. And it's only when I switched over to oncology about 20 years ago that I suddenly became aware of all this terminology and how misleading it was. And I felt totally misled through my sort of medical career. And I think we need to make this understood that when you go to the oncologist and he looks at your CT scan and he can't see the tumor on it and you've had the chemotherapy, and he'll say, oh, you've had a complete response. And that does not mean you're cured. What it means is he cannot see your tumor on the CT scan, all right? But if you have a CT scan 6 weeks later and all the tumor is back again, you still had a complete response in oncology terms. Mm. So the terms mean nothing, all right? If you have a partial response, it means the tumor shrunk by about 50%, you know? But again, these terms mean nothing. And I think you have to keep this in mind. You know, don't go away thinking I'm cured, because the reality is, as I said before, chemotherapy on its own, with the exception of the testicular cancer and the uterine tumor I mentioned before, and the what I call the lymphomas, leukemias, most chemotherapy does not cure you, unfortunately.
No. There's another aspect to this as well, which is the intention of the treatment, I think, is another important thing. I think there can very often be a huge gulf between what the patient thinks the intention of treatment is and what the doctor thinks the intention of treatment is. So the doctor may know full well that the treatment he's giving is palliative only, i.e. it's only to possibly prolong the person's life by a short span and to reduce symptoms, whereas the patient might be going into it thinking, yeah, this might cure me. And I think those kind of gulfs are not often explored. They're not even identified quite often in the relationship. Do you want to say a bit about that?
Yeah. I totally agree with that. You always have two ends of the spectrum as far as oncologists are concerned. You have the young ones who tend to come in and don't want to discuss death at all, because death equals failure on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And then you have the elder oncologists, the more experienced ones, and they unfortunately have gone too much the other way. They'll sort of say, well, this is purely palliative, this will keep you alive for a short period of time. But if this doesn't work well, we could try something else. Whereas in reality, we need to be somewhere in between. We need to be telling the truth as oncologists and sort of saying, well, look, we know that this chemotherapy is highly unlikely to cure you, but don't worry, if that fails, there's another chemotherapy we can try. And again, if that one fails, there's a good chance we can try a third one, or we can look at trials which will help you along. If you go through all the chemotherapy and it fails, I think, the worst thing the oncologists do is they remove hope from people and say there's no chance, that this is the end of your life. And we've had people who come here just totally, can only just depressed, given up in life. And because of what their oncologist has said to them. And a lot of these people will basically go on to have quite a decent life you know, maybe for years without chemotherapy, whatever. And I always think it's a bit like, you know, the voodoo dolls in Haiti, or when you have the guy comes along and sort of say, you know, says basically, I'm a doctor, you're going to die, and they go in the corner and they just give up and die. And I think patients, you know, with tumours do exactly the same type of thing if they don't get the support which they need. And, you know, the worst thing, I think, is the why do oncologists insist, for example, that patients shouldn't take any complementary therapies together with their chemotherapy? And I have patients come back, as they say, it will interfere with my chemotherapy, when there's absolutely no evidence for the vast majority that there is any interaction whatsoever. And I always tell the patients, you know, if your oncologist is saying that, and your oncologist says, show me the evidence, you go back to him and you ask him to show you the evidence that the complementary therapy you're taking interacts with the chemotherapy he's giving you. And when they do that, then they usually can't answer. We have to learn to fight our corner. You have to fight back.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. You've got a very nice little bullet point summary at the end of your chapter, which I thought I'd just read it, if you don't mind. It's great, and it covers a lot of the key points of your chapter. And these are your bullet points. Put yourself in charge of your case. We've mentioned that one already. Be sure that you trust and want to work with your oncologist. We haven't explored that so much. Prepare well for meetings and take someone with you. Very important. Make absolutely sure that you get all the answers you need. Don't allow yourself to be rushed into important decisions. That's another important one.
Yeah.
You're entitled to second opinions. Don't put off pursuing them. Be prepared to explore other options yourself. And we covered that pretty well. And lastly, consider asking someone to manage your communications with friends and relatives. So that's something you explore a bit at the end of your chapter, is the difficulty of continually passing on news to streams of concerned friends and relatives, maybe telling the same story over and over again, sometimes a very difficult one. And yes, this is something that people need to manage if they're to manage their emotions quite often through this period. So those are a fantastic lineups, really, of very real-world things to deal with. Is there anything else that jumped out from there that you want to say a bit more about?
Obviously, I think the most obvious thing, Robin, is going back to what I said earlier on, the treatment of the body is holistic, and you mustn't just rely on chemotherapy, radiotherapy, immunotherapy. You have to look after yourself. And I mean, this is what the whole book's about anyway. That's exactly so important. And, you know, do not rely on your oncologist to get you through this. You've got to help yourself. And most important, you know, one of the most important things we talk about, you know, we talk about diet, we talk about exercise. Diet is very difficult, you know, to prove in oncology how much difference it makes. But we certainly know, you know, exercise, people who exercise, look after themselves, they definitely do much better than others. And I think you've got to say, you've got to make your own plan to fight this cancer. Don't rely on going to the oncologist and sort of say, yes, sir, three bags full, sir, I'll do exactly what you say, and I'll do nothing against that. You know, I think you have to regain control as much as possible of the management of your tumour. Use the charities around you, like your own and like mine, who can sort of guide you to do the right thing. And finally, just as long as you feel strong and don't give up, keep fighting. And I say we're surprised how many people here who the oncologist said, you'll never see next Christmas. And not only have they seen that Christmas, but they've seen the following Christmas. And that's without any input at all from the oncologist. And it's nice to see that. And it's nice for other patients to see that as well. You can help yourself. And I think this is one of the most important things. But do, you know, you get all the support from those around you. And I say that's what your family's for. That's what, you know, the cancer charities are for. And we just have to accept that the NHS hasn't got the money all the time to help us in certain areas. And that's what our job is to fill those voids.
Right with you there. All right. So lastly, I want to give you the chance to tell listeners about your own baby there, the fantastic charity Star Throws that you've mentioned a few times throughout this interview. So you set that up to extend the care on offer to those with cancer. Before I get you to say something about it, I'd like to read your own little story that's on the website, which it alludes to the name, the unusual name of the charity, if I may. It says, after a heavy storm, a boy walked along the beach, throwing the stranded starfish back into the sea. A man watching shouted, there are too many of them, it won't make any difference. As the boy threw another starfish back into the sea, he smiled and replied, it made a difference to that one. I love that little story of yours, and I can see why you called the charity as you did, and it's completely the way we're operating as well. There's millions of people out there with cancer, but we're making a lot of difference to some of them. Did you want to just say a bit more about Star Throwers and what you do?
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Yeah, I mean, as you say, I mean, the reason why I started up Star Throwers in the first place, and now, as such, I couldn't believe it's actually 7 years we've been open now, which is incredible. But it was because I was working in the oncology department in the hospital, and the amount of patients, and not only patients, there was actually more their relatives who would say to me, you know, doctor, I don't understand what's going on, or doctor, can you tell me, you know, what are the results of the scans and this and that. And because we were all rushing around, we never had the time to sit down properly with patients and go through with them and their families exactly what the situation was. I think I got so frustrated and sort of depressed with the whole system. That's why I decided to leave, and I went actually part-time to begin with, and then we started up Star Throwers. And so it's just been an absolutely fantastic success, not only because people can come here and I can explain to them exactly what's going on. We've also got all the nice complementary therapies here, the massage, the Reiki, the counsellors. And what's wonderful about here is just like your organization, all these people work, you know, on a voluntary basis. They come in, they give their time. When patients come here for the first time, they sort of say, well, it's just so opposite to a hospital. It's nice, friendly, you feel warmth as soon as you come through the front door. That's what it's all about. It's integrative care. We have to work together to help people through this situation. And I think that's what people really appreciate more than anything else, having somebody to talk to when they need it. When they don't understand things, when they go to the oncologist and he sort of says, oh, it's, you know, good news or bad news, whatever, and they want to know exactly what they mean by that. And they can come back here. And I always tell them they have to have a copy of their notes, a report of their CT scan. So we know, I can look at it and sort of say, yeah, this is good news, this is bad news. And, you know, if it's bad news, then we have to turn it. We have to say, right, what are we going to do about this? Nice. And, you know, this is the whole point. It's not to be negative. It's like the boy throwing the starfish back in the sea. We're always throwing starfish back in the sea, and we're determined. We will not give up. We see one that's floundering on the beach, we will pick them up and throw them anyway.
Right. Great stuff. I love it. Okay, that's really great. So, look, that's all we got time for, Henry. A massive thank you for sharing your really valuable experience and insight freely to those with cancer in your fantastic chapter in The Cancer Revolution. I know that's going to be a great resource to people. And thanks also for coming on today.
Thank you very much indeed, Robin. Much appreciated. Lovely talk to you.
That's all for this week's show. Next week is going to be the last in this series about The Cancer Revolution, and it features a very special guest, so don't miss it. As I mentioned at the start of the show, The Cancer Revolution is now available from bookshops and from Amazon, and you can also buy it directly off The Cancer Revolution website, thecancerrevolution.co.uk, which is well worth a visit anyway, as it's now been expanded into a full website about the book, and it features additional information. Links to material featured in today's show are on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. Just click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and choose UK Health Radio. And please also follow us on Facebook, on my page, Robin Daly. Yes to Life has a page, and so does The Cancer Revolution. Also on Twitter, at @RMK_Daly, at Yes to Life, and at Cancer Rev now. Thanks for listening today. Goodbye.